Broadcasting across the United States, Canada, and around the world, this is the Best of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Your host for the program is Hank Hanegraaff, president of the Christian Research Institute. We're on the air because life and truth matter. For more information, resources, or to donate to CRI, call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. The following program was pre-recorded. To start today's Bible Answer Man broadcast, here's your host, Hank Hanegraaff.
Thank you very much, Randy. And as always, it is a pleasure to be in studio as we answer questions that are coming in from around the world. Our contact information on the web, equip.org. Via the mail, it's Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. And resource consultants are standing by, 888-7000, and the letters CRI. We'll go right to the phone calls. First up is Joyce. She's listening in California. Hi, Joyce.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
I was reading back in Genesis again, and in Genesis chapter 6, verses 4 through 6. Could you explain that to me, what they're talking about the Son of Man and the Nephilim and coming down and marrying humans?
Sure. This is, of course, the classic chapter on the flood. And the flood is a judgment on sinful humanity. But people have read into the phrase, sons of God. They've read into that phrase, angels, and at that, fallen angels who have sex with women. And through that sexual union with women, they produce giants, Nephilim. That's the basic theory. That theory, of course, has a lot to do with mythology and nothing to do with theology. And the mistake that's being made here is the mistake that people take a phrase and read the same meaning into that phrase, whether it's found in one context or another. And that is a violation of a basic principle in the art and science of biblical interpretation, but also a violation of common sense. Words and phrases are not univocal, they're equivocal. They take on the meaning that a context allows them to have. So in some context, you can have the sons of God meaning angels or angelic beings. In other contexts, it can mean simply men being described in a particular way, human beings. And this we see in many other examples or parallels. For example, Satan is called God. God is called God. People are called gods, all in the scripture. But if you look at the context, you immediately see that when Satan is called God, it does not in any way imply that he is the one who spoke and the universe leapt into existence, or that he is not, as the Bible describes, a created being. Of course, he's a created being, and he didn't create the world. He is the God of this world in the sense that this world is fallen, and fallen humanity have fallen with the angelic hosts. They've fallen in lives of perpetual sin, terminated by death. When men are called gods, they're called gods in the sense of being representatives of God to the people, but in the same text that they're called gods, it says they'll die like the mere mortals that they are. Of course, God is called God, but always in the sense that he is the one who spoke and the universe leapt into existence. So again, words and phrases are not univocal, they're equivocal. They take on the meaning that the context allows them to have. And the idea that fallen angels can have sex with women, as I said, is mythological. It's not theological. Fallen angels are not physical, so they cannot have physical sex with women, nor can they create bodies, because they would then have a prerogative that is the prerogative of God alone. Now, God can allow an angel to take on physical form, but Satan cannot create physical form.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't think so. I didn't think angels were male nor female.
Yeah, and if they were able to have sex with women then, why could they not have sex with women now? I mean, it raises all kinds of conundrums. And the other thing that is a principle in Scripture that would be violated is that kinds reproduce after their own kinds. So a fallen angel cannot cohabitate with a woman even if that angel had physicality, just like a woman cannot have sex with an animal and bear a child. It simply doesn't work that way.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you taking my call.
You're absolutely welcome, and I've written about this in the Complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition, revised and updated. Back to the phone lines. We'll talk to Anthony next, listening in Topeka, Kansas. Hi.
Well, hi, Hank. How are you doing?
Doing well. Thank you.
Last night, I was online responding to someone's objection to Christians objecting to homosexuality and not objecting to pork and nipped clothing. And what I tried to do as a everyday apologist was to point out that we have to make a distinction between what holds sway over believers today and what doesn't. I tried to say that laws like pork and shrimp were for Israel only. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with eating pork or shrimp. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with mixed clothing and that sort of thing. How would you handle something like that?
Yeah, and you know, I've written about this in some detail, answering every one of those questions that you posed in a book called Has God Spoken? Because this is an objection to the Bible that has been raised over and over again. But I think what you've done is fantastic. There's no credence whatsoever to the notion of unclean food or unclean animals in the sense that somehow or other we can't eat shellfish, or that eating shellfish is an abomination. And there's a quantum difference between a temporary type and an enduring ethical edict. The former is fulfilled and escalated in the antitype, and thus it's abrogated. The latter applies universally to all people in all places at all times, which is essentially what you pointed out as you were just explaining how you answered the question. So as I've said, it's a little more than a little messed up to say that Leviticus suggests slavery is okay and that eating shellfish is an abomination. The complex codes regarding the propriety of human relationships are hardly reducible to superficial sound bites, especially to those prone to impose New World realities on ancient biblical meanings and mores. So you think about the mischaracterization regarding shellfish. Subtle but misleading. Because it's right that you would say Leviticus characterizes the eating of shellfish as an abomination, but it's wrong in isolating this injunction from its biblical context. The distinction between clean and unclean foods symbolized the difference between that which was holy and that which was unholy within the context of an ancient theocratic form of government. And consequently, from a New Testament perspective, it is morally appropriate to eat shellfish just as it is morally appropriate to eat steaks. There's nothing wrong with it whatsoever. Jesus says, not what goes into a man's mouth, out through his body that defiles it. It's that which proceeds from the heart. So one here is a temporary law within a Mosaic context. The other, a function of natural law. And in fact, what's interesting about this is Paul says this is so plain that no one can really miss it, which is to say that even Gentiles who have no access to direct revelation have enough evidence in the natural realm to discover God's aversion to homosexual behavior. And God's aversion to homosexual behavior is not arbitrary or capricious. Rather, it is loving. He puts parameters around our lives so that our joy might be complete. The people that are unloving are the people that are pulling those parameters away and saying, don't worry, it's not going to hurt you. It's kind of like a doctor saying, don't worry about your cancer, you'll be just fine. Keep eating and doing things that are carcinogenic or that lead in that direction. It's unloving, it's unkind, but everything in this world seems to be topsy-turvy today. Seems to me almost incredible to imagine, but here we are.
Yeah, right. We're like the Poseidon upside down and sinking, but try to shed some light. Appreciate you and your ministry, Hank.
Well, thank you, and I think you did a great job in answering the question. You know, if you try to circumvent natural law, it's very much like cutting off the branch in which you're sitting. You're going to take a great big fall. You simply cannot go against natural law and not be hurt. It's very much like the law of gravity. You break the law of gravity and you take a great big fall. Sometimes we look at Mosaic law as though it doesn't make any sense. When you understand Mosaic law within its intended context, it makes a whole lot of sense. And the provisions within Mosaic law oftentimes exceed that of modern jurisprudence. I was with a lawyer friend yesterday, and he was talking about the depth to which his profession has sunk. And I was thinking about that in respect to this question as well. The other part of it is it's very, very difficult to reduce all of this, as I mentioned, to sound bites. And I think in many ways, what we have to do is not simply take the default position of saying the Bible has to be wrong, but we have to take the time to understand what the Bible is saying within its intended context. Be right back with more answers to your questions.
Every Bible Answer Man broadcast, such as the one you're listening to right now, is made possible through the financial support of friends like you. Each month, we depend entirely on God's provision through His people to bring you more of the broadcast, podcast, and other resources you rely on. If you want a sound proclamation and defense of the gospel of Jesus Christ to continue to be heard through the outreaches of the Christian Research Institute, become a member of CRI's support team today. Call 888-7000-CRI and stand with CRI daily in the battle for life and truth. That's 888-7000-CRI. Or visit our website at equip.org. We'll return shortly with more from Hank Hanegraaff. Has God spoken? Are the words of Scripture merely human in origin, or are they in fact the very words of God Himself? 3 years in the making, and based on two decades of research and reflection, Hank Hanegraaff's monumental book, Has God Spoken?, answers what is surely the most important question facing our world. In Has God Spoken? Memorable Proofs of the Bible's Divine Inspiration, Hank counters the contentions of the Bible attackers and clearly shows that belief in the Holy Scriptures is not a guess or wishful thinking. It is the only logical conclusion after an honest examination of overwhelming evidence. Order Has God Spoken? From the Christian Research Institute by calling 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. Equip.org. The number of wolves surrounding the Christian flock is growing, and they relish nothing more than docile sheep utterly incapable of defending themselves. From militant secularists at home to militant Islamists abroad, the assaults on biblical Christianity are growing dangerously. But Christian Research Institute support team members aren't in favor of feeding these wolves. Instead, each day they're making possible an array of outreaches that defang these wolf packs with solid arguments and evidence that have stood the test of time. What's more, support team members are equipping themselves with CRI's Equipping Essentials, a hand-picked collection of the best apologetics tools around. Your selection of resources, along with a complimentary subscription to the Christian Research Journal, are just our way of saying thanks. To learn more about the benefits of membership, simply visit equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org. A deeper understanding of the Bible's principles and truths will improve the spiritual, moral, and ethical problems facing our nation. Yet the obstacle isn't that the Bible doesn't speak to our greatest needs or answer our deepest questions. It's that the average person lacks the time and tools to extract the answers. That's why Hank Hanegraaff wrote the complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition, revised and updated. This expanded edition addresses over 210 of the top questions he's received as host of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Hank has taken the complex and made it simple and memorable. Receive the revised and updated complete Bible Answer Book as our thank you for your gift by calling 888-7000-CRI. And make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI.
or visit equip.org. That's equip.org.
And now, here's Hank Hanegraaff.
Thank you much, Randy. And right back to our phone caller. Sean is next in Kirksville, Missouri. Hi, Sean.
Hi. I appreciate your program. Been blessed by it many times.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was wondering, what is the Bible view of remarriage?
Well, first of all, I think to set the table, you have to look at the clear words of the Lord, "I hate divorce." So the whole idea of marriage is not only the propagation of the human race, but also it is a parable of Christ and his church. And therefore, it is a very powerful message of reconciliation to the world. So marriage should be preserved at all costs. We have fallen into the land of no-fault divorce. It's easy to get in and just as easy to get out. And instead of seeing love as a commitment, we see love as a feeling. And that has led to all kinds of people getting out of difficult marriages without recognizing that all marriages are difficult. It is the sandpaper that takes off our rough edges. And when we're committed, a marriage can last. But when we're simply basing our relationship on feelings, feelings ebb and flow. And so the marriage is not all that likely to last. So the precedent is that love is not just a feeling, it's a commitment, and that we are to be committed to our spouses as Christ is committed to the church. Now, if there is a divorce that takes place because an unbeliever leaves a relationship, the believer is not bound in that circumstance, according to the Apostle Paul. However, if the unbeliever is willing to stay, the believer must not get a divorce. Again, the sanctification of the unbeliever comes through the relationship. Doesn't mean that that person is saved through the relationship, but certainly that they come under the influence, the direct influence of the graces of God that are given to their spouse. There are circumstances, however, where you have a person who is involved in continuous willful disobedience to the principles of the kingdom, and even pose a threat to the family in physical ways, and show that they are unrepentant in their attitude, and then they get involved in another relationship, and they cut the possibility of restoration. That can happen through death, it can happen through another marriage, it can happen various ways. The idea, however, is if it is possible to effect reconciliation, we try to do that. If not, then this is a decision made by the other party who refuses reconciliation. In terms of the technicality of the biblical grounds for divorce and remarriage, we actually did an article in the Christian Research Journal that is, I think, very, very helpful, written by Dr. Mike Ross. And if you want, you can hang on and get that out to you, or you can find it on the web at equip.org. Let's go back to the phone lines. We'll talk to Dana. She's listening in Columbia, Missouri. Hi, Dana.
Hi, Hank. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you.
And thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
Hank, my question is fairly simple. I've recently discovered some information because I look at why we believe the things we do and we look at the history of things. And it has come to my attention that through something I have seen as far as a video, that there were several very large religions before Christianity that have the same story of 12 disciples, death and resurrection, 3 days, virgin birth. And they were major religions before Christianity and the Christ came about. Is that just a coincidence? And what should I take from that?
Well, what you should take from that is that you cannot believe everything you watch on the internet or you see on television, like Zeitgeist, which is a classic twisting of truth. The alleged similarities, as well as the terminology that is used to communicate them, are greatly exaggerated. So, for example, the resurrection of Osiris, so often compared to the resurrection of Jesus Christ, the stretch is pretty obvious, and that, for the mystery religions, is about as good as it gets. In terms of timing, The truth of the matter is most mysteries flourished long after the closing of the canon of Scripture. Not only that, but mystery religions reduced reality to a personal experience of enlightenment. In contrast, followers of Christ were committed to essential Christian doctrine. Devotees worked themselves into altered states of consciousness because they believed that experience was a better teacher than words. So their whole way of meditation, distinctly different from Christian meditation, which is always object-oriented. And then I would also point out, and this is all stuff that's left out of the narrative, is that the mystery religions were largely syncretistic. And what I mean by that is adherents not only worshipped various pagan deities, but they also frequently embraced aspects of competing mystery religions while continuing to worship within their own cultic constructs. Well, what does Christianity say? Converts to Christ singularly place their faith in the one who said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. The whole idea of syncretism in Christianity is abhorrent. So at foundational levels, the differences between the mystery religions and Christianity is the difference between night and day. There's no way you can harmonize them. And so the narrative that you hear in some of these internet movies and elsewhere are simply narratives that do not correspond to reality.
Okay. I hear what you're saying. I can understand that. But let's take an instance here. Let's take December 25th, that we celebrate Christmas. December 25th is a pagan festival of light. Am I not correct there?
Well, yeah, but here's what you have to understand about that. The simple answer to that is that Christianity did not seek in any way to simply establish paganism as part of their deal in a syncretistic fashion. Rather, what Christianity did was they established a rival celebration to the pagan celebration, saying that the real answer is the incarnation of Christ, who lived the perfect life that we can never live and offers us his perfection as an absolutely free gift. You can't earn it. You can't deserve it. You can simply reach out the hand of a beggar to receive the gift of a king. So the idea here is not that somehow or other Christianity sort of had a muddy mix with the pagan religions. No, it set up a rival celebration and did that intentionally.
Okay. Well, you're the first person that's ever admitted that and said that. Absolutely. I asked somebody else at a church, and they asked me to leave.
Well, I love the conversation. I'm glad you're asking the question.
Thank you, and thank you for being there.
You got it. Thank you so much for your call, Dana. I've written about this, by the way, in the Complete Bible Answer Book, Collector's Edition, revised and updated. Back to the phone lines, Anthony in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, Leon. How are you?
Good, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
I'm just trying to get your take on Revelations 20, verses 7 to 9.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, this is, of course, the great story of Revelation, the great meta-narrative, and it's culminating in the fact that there is going to be a new heaven and a new earth wherein dwells righteousness. But in Revelation chapter 20, at the end of the passage, when the 1,000 years are over, Satan is going to be released from his prison. He's going to go out to deceive the nations in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle. In number, they're like the sand on the seashore. They marched across the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of God's people, the city he loves. But then fire comes down from heaven and devours them, and the devil who deceived them is thrown into the lake of burning sulfur, where the beast and the false prophet have been thrown, and they're going to be tormented day and night forever and ever. That is the culmination. Then you have the great white throne judgment, where the dead, great, and small appear before the throne. But in this grand meta-narrative, what you have is the idea of Satan released after 1,000 years, or a way of saying that after Christ had made a spectacle of the principalities and powers of darkness, made a spectacle of the domain of Satan, Satan must yet be released for a short time. So this is part of John's narrative communicated in apocalyptic language. There's no warrant whatsoever for suggesting, as many do today, that this narrative has to do with the 21st century, that you're going to have first a rebuilt temple in the tribulation period, and then you're going to have a rebuilt millennial temple, and then after Christ presides over the millennial temple, then you're going to have Gog and Magog to gather them for battle, and number they're like the sand of the seashore, they march across the breadth. So you have the greatest apostasy in the history of humanity happening on Christ's watch during a semi-golden age. This is something I think that's imposed on the scripture as opposed to extracted from the scripture. I've written about this in various places. One, the Complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition, revised and updated. The other, my book, The Apocalypse Code, which also is available through the ministry. You can find it online at equip.org. Going to have to leave it at that, Anthony, because I am just flat out of time for this edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Do remember, we stand shoulder to shoulder in the battle for life and truth, because what we do now counts for all eternity.
Thanks for joining us for the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. Our daily commitment here at CRI is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. If you'd like to order resources or listen to the broadcast online, visit our website at equip.org. That's equip.org. Or call a resource consultant at 888-7000-274. Of course, you can write to CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is supported by listeners like you. We're on the air because life and truth matter. Anyone who's been paying attention knows there's a war going on, not just on traditional morality, civility, and decency, but even more fundamentally on historic notions of truth. And the enemy isn't just the onslaught of fake news facilitated by a post-truth culture and turbocharged by growing legions of ideological spin doctors. No, the real enemies of truth range from postmodernist convictions that there is no objective truth to militant scientism that claims that only science can determine truth, and religion is little more than primitive superstitions. But CRI support team members are not waving a white flag of surrender. They're holding the fort by undergirding every one of Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping and life-changing outreaches 24/7. To learn how you can make a difference and enjoy all the benefits of support team membership, simply visit equip.org.